Lillian was not present in the courtroom. Her attorney made gestures once in a while, with the energy of letting water run through his fingers. They all knew the verdict in advance, and they knew its reason. No other reason had existed for years, where no standard, save whim, had existed. They seemed to regard it as their rightful prerogative. They acted as if the purpose of the procedure were not to try a case, but to give them jobs, as if their jobs were to recite the appropriate formulas, with no responsibility to know what the formulas accomplished. As if a courtroom were the one place where questions of right and wrong were irrelevant. And they, the men in charge of dispensing justice, were safely wise enough to know that no justice existed. They acted like savages, performing a ritual devised to set them free of objective reality. But the 10 years of his marriage had been real, he thought, and these were the men who assumed the power to dispose of it, to decide whether he would have a chance of contentment on earth, or be condemned to torture for the rest of his lifetime. He remembered the austerely pitiless respect he had felt for his contract of marriage, for all his contracts and all his legal obligations, and he saw what sort of legality his scrupulous observance was expected to serve. He noticed that the puppets of the courtroom had started by glancing at him in the sly, wise manner of fellow conspirators, sharing a common guilt, mutually safe from moral condemnation. Then, when they observed that he was the only man in the room who looked steadily straight at anyone's face, he saw resentment growing in their eyes. Incredulously, he realized what it was that had been expected of him. He, the victim, chained, bound, gagged, and left with no recourse save to bribery, had been expected to believe that the farce he had purchased was a process of law, that the edicts enslaving him had moral validity, that he was guilty of corrupting the integrity of the guardians of justice, and that the blame was his, not theirs. It was like blaming the victim of a holdup for corrupting the integrity of the thug. And yet, he thought, through all the generations of political extortion, it was not the looting bureaucrats who had taken the blame, but the chained industrialists. Not the men who peddled legal favors, but the men who were forced to buy them. And through all those generations of crusades against corruption, the remedy had always been not the liberating of the victims, but the granting of wider powers for extortion to the extortionists. The only guilt of the victims, he thought, had been that they had accepted it as guilt. When he walked out of the courtroom into the chilly drizzle of a gray afternoon, he felt as if he had been divorced not only from Lillian, but from the whole of the human society that supported the procedure he had witnessed. The face of his attorney, an elderly man of the old-fashioned school, wore an expression that made it look as if he longed to take a bath. "Say, Hank," he asked as sole comment, "is there something the looters are anxious to get from you right now?"
"Not that I know of. Why?"
"The thing went too smoothly. There were a few points at which I expected pressure and hints for some extras, but the boys sailed past and took no advantage of it. Looks to me as if orders had come from on high to treat you gently and let you have your way. Are they planning something against your mills?"
"Not that I know of," said Reardon,
and was astonished to hear it in his mind.
"Not that I care."
It was on the same afternoon at the mills that he saw the wet nurse hurrying toward him, a gangling, coltish figure with a peculiar mixture of brusqueness, awkwardness, and decisiveness. "Mr. Reardon, I would like to speak to you." His voice was diffident, yet oddly firm.
"Go ahead."
"There's something I want to ask you."
The boy's face was solemn and taut.
"I want you to know that I know you should refuse me, but I want to ask it just the same. And if it's presumptuous, then just tell me to go to hell."
"Okay, try it."
"Mr. Reardon, would you give me a job?" It was the effort to sound normal that betrayed the days of struggle behind the question. "I want to quit what I'm doing and go to work. I mean real work in steelmaking, like I thought I'd started to once. I want to earn my keep. I'm tired of being a bedbug." Reardon could not resist smiling and reminding him in the tone of a quotation.
"Now why use such words, non-absolute? If we don't use ugly words, we won't have any ugliness, and..."
But he saw the desperate earnestness of the boy's face and stopped. his smile vanishing. "I mean it, Mr. Reardon. And I know what the word means, and it's the right word. I'm tired of being paid with your money to do nothing except make it impossible for you to make any money at all. I know that anyone who works today is only a sucker for bastards like me, but... Well, goddammit, I'd rather be a sucker if that's all there's left to be." His voice had risen to a cry. "I beg your pardon, Mr. Reardon," he said stiffly, looking away. In a moment he went on in his woodenly unemotional tone. "I want to get out of the deputy director of distribution racket. I don't know that I'd be of much use to you. I've got a college diploma in metallurgy, but that's not worth the paper it's printed on. But I think I've learned a little about the work in the 2 years I've been here, and if you could use me at all as sweeper or scrap man or whatever you trust me with, I'd tell them where to put the deputy directorship, and I'd go to work for you tomorrow, next week, this minute, or whenever you say." He avoided looking at Reardon, not in a manner of evasion, but as if he had no right to do it.
"Why were you afraid to ask me?" said Reardon gently.
The boy glanced at him with indignant astonishment, as if the answer were self-evident. "Because after the way I started here and the way I acted and what I'm deputy of, if I come asking you for favors, you ought to kick me in the teeth."
"You have learned a great deal in the 2 years you've been here."
"No, I..."
He glanced at Reardon, understood, looked away, and said woodenly,
"Yeah, if that's what you mean."
"Listen, kid, I'd give you a job this minute, and I'd trust you with more than a sweeper's job if it were up to me. But have you forgotten the Unification Board? I'm not allowed to hire you, and you're not allowed to quit. Sure, men are quitting all the time, and we're hiring others under phony names and fancy papers proving that they've worked here for years. You know it, and thanks for keeping your mouth shut. But do you think that if I hired you that way, your friends in Washington would miss it?"
The boy shook his head slowly.
"Do you think that if you quit their service to become a sweeper, they wouldn't understand your reason?"
The boy nodded.
"Would they let you go?"
The boy shook his head. After a moment, he said in a tone of forlorn astonishment, "I hadn't thought of that at all, Mr. Reardon. I forgot them. I kept thinking of whether you'd want me or not, and that the only thing that counted was your decision."
"I know."
"And it is the only thing that counts, in fact."
"Yes, non-absolute. In fact."
The boy's mouth jerked suddenly into the brief, mirthless twist of a smile. "I guess I'm tied worse than any sucker."
"Yes. There's nothing you can do now except apply to the Unification Board for permission to change your job. I'll support your application if you want to try. Only I don't think they'll grant it. I don't think they'll let you work for me."
"No, they won't."
"If you maneuver enough and lie enough, they might permit you to transfer to a private job with some other steel company."
"No, I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to leave this place."
He stood looking off at the invisible vapor of rain over the flame of the furnaces. After a while, he said quietly, "I'd better stay put, I guess. I'd better go on being a deputy looter. Besides, if I left, God only knows what sort of bastard they'd saddle you with in my place."
He turned. "They're up to something, Mr. Reardon. I don't know what it is, but they're getting ready to spring something on you."
"What?"
"I don't know. But they've been watching every opening here in the last few weeks, every desertion, and slipping their own gang in. A queer sort of gang, too, real goons, some of them, that I'd swear never stepped inside a steel plant before. I've had orders to get as many of our boys in as possible. They wouldn't tell me why. I don't know what it is they're planning. I've tried to pump them, but they're acting pretty cagey about it. I don't think they trust me anymore. I'm losing the right touch, I guess. All I know is they're getting set to pull something here."
"Thanks for warning me."
"I'll try to get the dope on it. I'll try my damnedest to get it in time."
He turned brusquely and started off, but stopped. "Mr. Reardon, if it were up to you, you would have hired me?"
"I would have gladly and at once."
"Thank you, Mr. Reardon,"
he said, his voice solemn and low, then walked away. Reardon stood looking after him, seeing with a tearing smile of pity. what it was that the ex-relativist, the ex-pragmatist, the ex-amoralist was carrying away with him for consolation. On the afternoon of September 11th, a copper wire broke in Minnesota, stopping the belts of a grain elevator at a small country station of Taggart Transcontinental. A flood of wheat was moving down the highways, the roads, the abandoned trails of the countryside, emptying thousands of acres of farmland upon the fragile dams of the railroad stations. It was moving day and night, the first trickles growing into streams, then rivers, then torrents, moving on palsied trucks with coughing tubercular motors, on wagons pulled by the rusty skeletons of starving horses, on carts pulled by oxen, on the nerves and last energy of men who had lived through 2 years of disaster for the triumphant reward of this autumn's giant harvest. Men who had patched their trucks and carts with wire, blankets, ropes, and sleepless nights to make them hold together for this one more journey, to carry the grain and collapse at destination, but to give their owners a chance at survival. Every year at this season, another movement had gone clicking across the country, drawing freight cars from all corners of the continent to the Minnesota division of Taggart Transcontinental, the beat of train wheels preceding the creak of the wagons, like an advance echo rigorously planned, ordered, and timed to meet the flood. The Minnesota division drowsed through the year to come to violent life for the sounds of the harvest. 14,000 freight cars had jammed its yards each year. 15,000 were expected this time. The first of the wheat trains had started to channel the flood into the hungry flour mills, then bakeries, then stomachs of the nation. But every train, car, and storage elevator counted, and there was no minute or inch of space to spare. Eddie Willers watched Dagny's face as she went through the cards of her emergency file. He could tell the content of the cards by her expression. "The terminal," she said quietly, closing the file. "Phone the terminal downstairs and have them ship half their stock of wire to Minnesota." Eddie said nothing and obeyed. He said nothing the morning when he put on her desk a telegram from the Taggart office in Washington, informing them of the directive which, due to the critical shortage of copper, ordered government agents to seize all copper mines and operate them as a public utility. "Well," she said, dropping the telegram into the wastebasket, "that's the end of Montana." She said nothing when James Taggart announced to her that he was issuing an order to discontinue all dining cars on Taggart trains. "We can't afford it any longer," he explained. "We've always lost money on those goddamn diners. And when there's no food to get, when restaurants are closing because they can't grab hold of a pound of horse meat anywhere, how can railroads be expected to do it? Why in hell should we have to feed the passengers anyway? They're lucky if we give them transportation. They travel in cattle cars if necessary. Let them pack their own box lunches. What do we care? They've got no other trains to take." The telephone on her desk had become not a voice of business, but an alarm siren for the desperate appeals of disaster. "Miss Taggart, we have no copper wire. Nails, Miss Taggart, plain nails. Could you tell somebody to send us a keg of nails? Can you find any paint, Miss Taggart? Any sort of waterproof paint anywhere?" But $30 million of subsidy money from Washington had been plowed into Project Soybean, an enormous acreage in Louisiana where a harvest of soybeans was ripening, as advocated and organized by Emma Chalmers, for the purpose of reconditioning the dietary habits of the nation. Emma Chalmers, better known as Kip's Ma, was an old sociologist who had hung about Washington for years, as other women of her age and type hang about bar rooms. For some reason which nobody could define, the death of her son in the tunnel catastrophe had given her in Washington an aura of martyrdom, heightened by her recent conversion to Buddhism. "The soybean is a much more sturdy, nutritious, and economical plant than all the extravagant foods which our wasteful, self-indulgent diet has conditioned us to expect," Kip's Ma had said over the radio. Her voice always sounded as if it were falling in drops, not of water, but of mayonnaise. "Soybeans make an excellent substitute for bread, meat, cereals, and coffee, and if all of us were compelled to adopt soybeans as our staple diet, it would solve the national food crisis and make it possible to feed more people. The greatest food for the greatest number, that's my slogan. At a time of desperate public need, it's our duty to sacrifice our luxurious tastes and eat our way back to prosperity by adapting ourselves to the simple, wholesome foodstuff on which the peoples of the Orient have so nobly subsisted for centuries. There's a great deal that we could learn from the peoples of the Orient.
Copper tubing, Miss Taggart. Could you get some copper tubing for us somewhere? The voices were pleading over her telephone.
Rail spikes, Miss Taggart.
Screwdrivers, Miss Taggart.
Light bulbs, Miss Taggart. There's no electric light bulbs to be had anywhere within 200 miles of us.
But $5 million was being spent by the Office of Morale Conditioning on the People's Opera Company, which traveled through the country giving free performances to people who, on one meal a day, could not afford the energy to walk to the opera house. $7 million had been granted to a psychologist in charge of a project to solve the world crisis by research into the nature of brother love. $10 million had been granted to the manufacturer of a new electronic cigarette lighter. But there were no cigarettes in the shops of the country. There were flashlights on the market, but no batteries. There were radios, but no tubes. There were cameras, but no film. The production of airplanes had been declared temporarily suspended. Air travel for private purposes had been forbidden and reserved exclusively for missions of public need. An industrialist traveling to save his factory was not considered as publicly needed and could not get aboard a plane. An official traveling to collect taxes was and could.
People are stealing nuts and bolts out of rail plates, Miss Taggart. Stealing them at night and our stock is running out. The division storehouse is bare. What are we to do, Miss Taggart?
But a supercolor 4-foot screen television set was being erected for tourists in a people's park in Washington, and a supercyclotron for the study of cosmic rays was being erected at the State Science Institute, to be completed in 10 years.
The trouble with our modern world, Dr. Robert Stadler said over the radio at the ceremonies launching the construction of the cyclotron, is that too many people think too much. It is the cause of all our current fears and doubts. An enlightened citizenry should abandon the superstitious worship of logic and the outmoded reliance on reason. Just as laymen leave medicine to doctors and electronics to engineers, so people who are not qualified to think should leave all thinking to the experts and have faith in the experts' higher authority. Only experts are able to understand the discoveries of modern science, which have proved that thought is an illusion and that the mind is a myth.
This age of misery is God's punishment to man for the sin of relying on his mind, snarled the triumphant voices of mystics of every sect and sort, on street corners in rain-soaked tents, in crumbling temples. This world ordeal is the result of man's attempt to live by reason. This is where thinking, logic, and science have brought you, and there's to be no salvation until men realize that their mortal mind is impotent to solve their problems and go back to faith, faith in God, faith in a higher authority.
And confronting her daily, there was the final product of it all, the heir and collector, Cuffy Meggs, the man impervious to thought. Cuffy Meggs strode through the offices of Taggart Transcontinental wearing a semi-military tunic and slapping a shiny leather briefcase against his shiny leather leggings. He carried an automatic pistol in one pocket and a rabbit's foot in the other. Cuffy Meggs tried to avoid her. His manner was part scorn, as if he considered her an impractical idealist, part superstitious awe, as if she possessed some incomprehensible power with which he preferred not to tangle. He acted as if her presence did not belong to his view of a railroad, yet as if hers were the one presence he dared not challenge. There was a touch of impatient resentment in his manner toward Jim, as if it were Jim's duty to deal with her and to protect him, just as he expected Jim to keep the railroad in running order and leave him free for activities of more practical a nature. So he expected Jim to keep her in line, as part of the equipment. Beyond the window of her office, like a patch of adhesive plaster stuck over a wound on the sky, the page of the calendar hung blank in the distance. The calendar had never been repaired since the night of Francisco's farewell. The officials who had rushed to the tower that night had knocked the calendar's motor to a stop while tearing the film out of the projector. They had found the small square of Francisco's message pasted into the strip of numbered days. But who had pasted it there, who had entered the locked room, and when and how, was never discovered by the three commissions still investigating the case.
pending the outcome of their efforts, the page hung blank and still above the city. It was blank on the afternoon of September 14th when the telephone rang in her office. "A man from Minnesota," said the voice of her secretary. She had told her secretary that she would accept all calls of this kind. They were the appeals for help, and her only source of information. At a time when the voices of railroad officials uttered nothing but sounds designed to avoid communication, the voices of nameless men were her last link to the system, the last sparks of reason and tortured honesty flashing briefly through the miles of Taggart Track.
"Miss Taggart, it is not my place to call you, but nobody else will," said the voice that came on the wire this time.
The voice sounded young and too calm.
"In another day or two, a disaster is going to happen here, the like of which they've never seen, and they won't be able to hide it any longer, only it will be too late by then. And maybe it's too late already."
"What is it? Who are you?"
"One of your employees of the Minnesota Division, Miss Taggart. In another day or two, the trains will stop running out of here. And you know what that means, at the height of the harvest. At the height of the biggest harvest we've ever had. They'll stop because we have no cars. The harvest freight cars have not been sent to us this year."
"What did you say?" She felt as if minutes went by between the words of the unnatural voice that did not sound like her own.
"The cars have not been sent. 15,000 should have been here by now. As far as I could learn, about 8,000 cars is all we've got. I've been calling division headquarters for a week. They've been telling me not to worry. Last time, they told me to mind my own damn business. Every shed, silo, elevator, warehouse, garage, and dance hall along the track is filled with wheat. At the Sherman elevators, there's a line of farmers' trucks and wagons 2 miles long waiting on the road. At Lakewood Station, the square is packed solid, and has been for 3 nights. They keep telling us it's only temporary, the cars are coming, and we'll catch up. We won't. There aren't any cars coming. I've called everyone I could. I know, by the way they answer. They know, and not one of them wants to admit it. They're scared, scared to move or speak or ask or answer. All they're thinking of is who will be blamed when that harvest rots here around the stations, and not of who's going to move it. Maybe nobody can now. Maybe there's nothing you can do about it either. But I thought you're the only person left who'd want to know, and that somebody had to tell you."
"I..." She made an effort to breathe.
"I see.
Who are you?"
"The name wouldn't matter. When I hang up, I will have become a deserter. I don't want to stay here to see it when it happens. I don't want any part of it anymore. Good luck to you, Miss Taggart."
She heard the click.
"Thank you," she said over a dead wire.
The next time she noticed the office around her and permitted herself to feel, it was noon of the following day. She stood in the middle of the office running stiff spread fingers through a strand of hair, brushing it back off her face, and for an instant, she wondered where she was, and what was the unbelievable thing that had happened in the last 20 hours. What she felt was horror, and she knew that she had felt it from the first words of the man on the wire, only there had been no time to know it. There was not much that remained in her mind of the last 20 hours, only disconnected bits held together by the single constant that had made them possible, by the soft, loose faces of men who fought to hide from themselves that they knew the answers to the questions she asked. From the moment when she was told that the manager of the car service department had been out of town for a week and had left no address where one could reach him, she knew that the report of the man from Minnesota was true. Then came the faces of the assistants in the car service department, who would neither confirm the report nor deny it, but kept showing her papers, orders, forms, file cards that bore words in the English language, but no connection to intelligible facts.
"Were the freight cars sent to Minnesota?" "Form 357W is filled out in every particular as required by the Office of the Coordinator in conformance with the instructions of the Controller and by Directive 11-493.
"Were the freight cars sent to Minnesota?"
"The entries for the month of August and September have been processed by..."
"Were the freight cars sent to Minnesota?"
"My files indicate the locations of freight cars by state, date, classification, and..."
"Do you know whether the cars were sent to Minnesota?"
"As to the interstate motion of freight cars, I would have to refer you to the files of Mr. Benson, and of..."
There was nothing to learn from the files. There were careful entries, each conveying four possible meanings, with references which led to references, which led to a final reference, which was missing from the files. It did not take her long to discover that the cars had not been sent to Minnesota, and that the order had come from Cuffy Meggs. But who had carried it out? Who had tangled the trail? What steps had been taken by what compliant men to preserve the appearance of a safely normal operation, without a single cry of protest to arouse some braver man's attention? Who had falsified the reports, and where the cars had gone, seemed at first impossible to learn. Through the hours of that night, while a small desperate crew under the command of Eddie Willers kept calling every division point, every yard, depot station, spur, and siding of Taggart Transcontinental for every freight car in sight or reach, ordering them to unload, drop, dump, scuttle, anything, and proceed to Minnesota at once, while they kept calling the yards, stations, and presidents of every railroad still half in existence, anywhere across the map, begging for cars for Minnesota, she went through the task of tracing from face to coward's face the destination of the freight cars that had vanished. She went from railroad executives to wealthy shippers to Washington officials and back to the railroad, by cab, by phone, by wire, pursuing a trail of half-uttered hints. The trail approached its end when she heard the pinch-lipped voice of a public relations woman in a Washington office, saying resentfully over the telephone wire, "Well, after all, it is a matter of opinion whether wheat is essential to a nation's welfare. There are those of more progressive views who feel that the soybean is perhaps of far greater value." And then, by noon, she stood in the middle of her office, knowing that the freight cars intended for the wheat of Minnesota had been sent instead to carry the soybeans from the Louisiana swamps of Kip's Ma's project. The first story of the Minnesota disaster appeared in the newspapers 3 days later. It reported that the farmers who had waited in the streets of Lakewood for 6 days with no place to store their wheat and no trains to carry it had demolished the local courthouse, the mayor's home, and the railroad station. Then the stories vanished abruptly, and the newspapers kept silent. Then began to print admonitions urging people not to believe unpatriotic rumors. While the flour mills and grain markets of the country were screaming over the phones and the telegraph wire, sending pleas to New York and delegations to Washington, while strings of freight cars from random corners of the continent were crawling like rusty caterpillars across the map in the direction of Minnesota, the wheat and hope of the country were waiting to perish along an empty track, under the unchanging green light of signals that called for motion to trains that were not there. At the communication desks of Taggart Transcontinental, a small crew kept calling for freight cars, repeating, like the crew of a sinking ship, an SOS that remained unheard. There were freight cars held loaded for months in the yards of the companies owned by the friends of pull peddlers, who ignored the frantic demands to unload the cars and release them. "You can tell that railroad to..." followed by untransmissible words, was the message of the Smather brothers in Arizona in answer to the SOS of New York. In Minnesota, they were seizing cars from every siding, from the Mesabi Range, from the ore mines of Paul Larkin, where the cars had stood waiting for a dribble of iron. They were pouring wheat into ore cars, into coal cars, into boarded stock cars that went spilling thin gold trickles along the track as they clattered off. They were pouring wheat into passenger coaches, over seats, racks, and fixtures, to send it off to get it moving, even if it went moving into trackside ditches in the sudden crash of breaking springs, in the explosions set off by burning journal boxes. They fought for movement with no thought of destination, for movement as such, like a paralytic under a stroke, struggling in wild, stiff, incredulous jerks, against the realization that movement was suddenly impossible. There were no other railroads. James Taggart had killed them. There were no boats on the lakes. Paul Larkin had destroyed them. There was only the single line of rail and a net of neglected highways. The trucks and wagons of waiting farmers started trickling blindly down the roads with no maps, no gas, no feed for horses, moving south, south toward the vision of flour mills awaiting them somewhere, with no knowledge of the distances ahead, but with the knowledge of death behind them. Moving to collapse on the roads, in the gullies, and the breaks of rotted bridges. One farmer was found half a mile south of the wreck of his truck, lying dead in a ditch face down, still clutching a sack of wheat on his shoulders. Then, rain clouds burst over the prairies of Minnesota. The rain went, eating the wheat into rot at the waiting railroad stations. It went, hammering the piles spilled along the roads, washing gold kernels into the soil.